Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I want to apologize. It's been a couple of weeks since the last one with Annette Brulee from Midfield Wine Bar. I was away in the summer in Croatia for a couple of weeks and then just getting back into the swing of work and everything, but no excuse. And I've got a lot of really good interviews that I did in late July and early August, some going back to really early July that I'm going to release. So here's what's going to happen. I usually been waiting about once every 10 or 12 days to put out a pod, and then it's been about 3 weeks. But for the next little while, I'm probably going to release one at least once a week, maybe one every 4 or 5 days, just get caught up because I got a lot of really good interviews set up and a lot of stuff I want to get to. And so, yeah, so thanks everyone for the patience. Thanks everyone who's been listening, subscribing to the podcast. Remember to tell a friend about it. And you can also, you can tweet me at mcause56. Any thoughts you have on the pod, anything you'd like to hear. So there's a bunch of stuff I want to get to. The interview today is with Chris Cooney, who's a winemaker at Dinah Estate, which is in California. And this guy, either at Dinah or at other wineries, he's made some of the top California wines over the past decade. I mean, just big, full-bodied wines. One's still with acid, still with that freshness. And Dinah, this estate, they could be on their way. I think they are close to becoming one of those cult status like wineries, which means they're not cheap. They aren't. Like, these are $100, $200, you know, well over sometimes $300, $400 bottles of wine. These are the rare ones. These are the ones you pick up one or two and you put them away, and then, you know, you drink them for an anniversary or New Year's or Christmas or something like that. These are not your casual wines, and they're excellent, and they're still far cheaper than, you know, your Harlan, you know, Screaming Eagle and stuff like that. They're not in that range, but they've gone well up in price over the last bunch of years. So he'll be joining me in just a moment. A couple quick thoughts about Croatia. One, they don't believe in plastic. Even on the beaches, like, we would go to the beaches, my girlfriend and her twin, for their birthday, and the beaches are rocky, a lot of pebbles, you know, it's not a lot of soft sand. And you'd go to the bars on the beach and the restaurants near the beach, and they, you know, order a bottle of wine, and they'd give you glass. You know, they give you glass stemware. There is no plastic in Croatia, which is weird because, you know, in Canada, we're always worried about safety and things like that. And I get it. You break a glass near a beach, that's a bummer. That is a real pain in the ass. On the other end, I much preferred drinking white wine on the beach with glass than plastic. If you ever go to Dubrovnik in Croatia, I cannot recommend high enough. It's just called the Dubrovnik Wine Tour. It's run by a guy named Mario, who is another WSET diploma graduate. Fantastic. Full day, fresh oysters, a bunch of different wineries, full lunch, really smart guy, entertaining guy. Cannot recommend it high enough. Dubrovnik Wine Tours. Didn't know a ton about Croatian wine. I mean, knew the names and obviously knew a lot about Primitivo there, which of course is Zinfandel. And we tried a bunch of those, really good. But there's a white grape, Posip, P-O-S-I-P, full-bodied whites that were excellent. And then the big one was Plavac Mali, and from this appellation, Dingach, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. And this appellation, it's like crazy steep, and it's just plunging into the Adriatic Sea. Gorgeous. And Plavac Mali, if you ever find it, it's interesting because it's a high alcohol wine. It's like 15 and a half, sometimes even bordering 16%. Like, it's high alcohol wine because it's just made in the hottest region in Croatia. So, you know, you'd expect a thick skin and, you know, big wine. But what I appreciated was it never tasted heavy. You never got that overwhelming on the back of your throat, your back of your neck sort of heat from the alcohol. And I appreciated that and tried a lot of really good stuff. So we don't get a lot of it here in Ontario. If you're listening somewhere else where you get more Croatian wine, fantastic. Try it. Plavac Mali is the name of the grape. And it's a big wine. It's not to be had with shellfish. You know, stick with the Posip for stuff like that. I also wanted to talk about, and I got wine from them ages ago. Rose Hall Run, which is a great small vineyard, the winemaker Dan Sullivan in Prince Edward County. And they gave me some wines to try. And my rule is if I say anything good about it, it's because I like it. Not because you gave it to me, not because you paid me, nothing like that. If I don't talk about some of the wines you send, it's because I just wasn't a big fan. But it's one of the philosophies on this podcast is that I'm going to do my best not to disparage or rip wines that that I don't like. I'm going to, and I know that might seem goody-two-shoe and just push you towards the good stuff, but I recognize that there's a lot of hands that go in making wine. There's a lot of reasons why I might not like the wine, which may be different than you that tries it. So I'd rather just push it to the good stuff. Every now and then I will, you know, be negative or tell you maybe steer clear of this chemical, you know, destruction of wine. But for the most part, I just try to be positive. And what I liked about it was, you know, it's Prince Edward County, so you're going to expect the Pinot Noir. But they also did a Petit Verdot and a Cab Franc and a Merlot. And these wines are all from single vineyard. So the quality is going to be a little bit better. These wines go for around $34. So they're not cheap, but they all bring something different. Like, you know, first off, the 2016 Pinot Noir, this was classic Prince Edward County Pinot. You know, the cherry, a little bit of tomato leaf, a little bit of this metallic note. It smells like Prince Edward County Pinot, a little bit of wood, vegetal. On the palate, raspberry, the cherry is there. There was like a light raisin note. I don't know if it's because it's had an extra year or so to age. Medium-bodied throat, good acid, good red fruit. Your classic Prince Edward County Pinot. If you're a fan of it, if you're a fan of the Clausen Chases or the, you know, the Stanners, things like that, Long Dog, you'll like this. The Cab Franc was interesting. There was a whole lot on the nose, a lot of red berries, some blackberry, earthy barnyard, some earthen barnyard. And on the palate, it starts out with this big juice raspberry mixed with a little bit of white pepper. Now, it wasn't an overly deep wine. You know, it wasn't like this crazy finish, but it was really pleasant. Notes of strawberry wrapped chocolate. And that, by the way, that's the most wine nerdy term I think I'll use for this. Really enjoyable finish. And I appreciated 13.5% alcohol, but didn't feel heavy. So if you like Cab Franc, I would certainly give this a try. There's small lots Merlot, classic Merlot, plush, welcoming on the nose, red fruit that hangs out with some plum, a lot of fruit, a little bit of pepper. And on the palate, same sort of notes, again, plush Merlot, tart strawberry, a bit of strawberry rhubarb, and a bit of a chocolate finish. And finally, a big aroma from the Petit Verdot, which isn't a surprise. Petit Verdot on its own, that's going to be a big wine. And I suggest give this one a shot because you don't usually drink 100% Petit Verdot. It's, you know, usually blended in Bordeaux blends and things like that. Earthy spice, more mushroom than I got on the Cab Franc, grippy tannins, green pepper, a little bit herbaceous, some of the chocolate and tobacco. And, you know, I appreciated these wines. Like Rose Hall Run does good stuff. And what I appreciate is you can get, you know, stuff that's a little bit less expensive, but then you can step up. And, you know, depending on your price point and just how much you put into your budget with wine, $34 isn't crazy when you consider it's, you know, we're talking like hand-picked, small vineyard, single vineyard. That's kind of around the price point you're going to pay for. And these wines, all varietally correct. You know, the Pinot tastes the way a Pinot's supposed to. Same thing with the Cab Franc and the Merlot and the Petit Verdot. So I think this was a really excellent job done by the team at Rose Hall Run, Dan Sullivan. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows I'm a big believer in Prince Edward County. This one, absolutely, these wines lived up to their expectations. I tried them a while ago at my girlfriend's aunt's cottage, and we just popped open all four and all took our own tasting notes. And, you know, they were making fun of me when I was saying things like strawberry wrapped chocolate or chocolate wrapped in strawberry, either one, pretty much the same thing. But give them a try. If you're in Prince Edward County, go give them a visit. So that's enough yammering for me. As I said, there will be a bunch more pods coming out in the next couple weeks. Again, sorry for the delay. Thank you again for everyone who's been listening. Looking forward to this fall. I'm going to be doing a ton of great stuff, ton of great winemakers and people that have influenced the world of wine, whether it's buyers, restaurant managers, some really good stuff coming up. So anyway, without further ado, enough of me yammering. And now from Dinant Estates, and trust me, I screw up the name a bunch of times, especially early in this pod. Here is an incredibly impressive winemaker. Here is Chris Cooney.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm here with a winemaker, and I always screw this up. It's just, is it Dana or Dana Estates?
So the correct pronunciation is Dana.
Dana. So both of mine were wrong.
Yes. But Dana is a Sanskrit word that means spirit of generosity.
Oh.
And it was a nickname given to our proprietor, Hisung Lee, when he was a child by a Buddhist monk.
Yeah. Okay, and I should, by the way, I've been rude. My guest is the winemaker for Dana Estates. I'm here with Chris Cooney. Chris, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
You're very welcome.
Okay, so Dana. Okay, now I feel good about this. How'd you get into wine? Like, was there an aha moment? Was there a bottle? Was there, you know, that call from the heavens that said, I need to learn about this?
So that moment, it didn't get me straight into the wine industry, but... my dad was into wine, mm-hmm. Sort of as a passionate, what I call wine enthusiast. And he bought wine because he liked drinking it. And he was very confident in knowing like what he liked and what he didn't like. But he really liked, he was into Bordeaux and Rhones, a little bit of California. But he had a wine tasting group. It was five or six couples that got together once a month and they would have dinner and wine tasting. And one of these wine tastings, I was, I think, sophomore or junior in college.
Yeah.
And I was home for the holidays. And he said, hey, if you do all the service for this dinner and you clean up afterwards, I'll let you sit down on the tasting. You know, are you interested in doing this? I said, sure. Like, I get to drink nice wine. And
yeah.
Like, I don't know anything about this stuff.
And so before that, like, your relationship with wine was what right up to that moment?
So my mother's from Germany, and so my dad and my mom had sort of this very European sensibility about wine, and that wine was really a food, mm-hmm. and that it was part of a meal.
Yeah.
And so you would have wine with dinner, and they would have wine, a glass of wine or two with dinner almost every single night. And so that was like, it was just sort of a normal thing to sit down and like, that there was wine on the table. So,
yeah, so just it was a normal part of your life. Because a lot of people, it's like, well, my parents didn't like it. I tried Blue Nun, and that's how I got into it. But for you, it was just more of your world.
Correct. And so yeah. I just sort of saw it as like, oh, it's of course you have. Of yeah. course there's wine with dinner. And like, you know, at this point, I couldn't afford anything. Like, it's not like I was buying anything, you know, above like, you know, $2 chuck would have been good.
Yeah. So what did you try that night?
So he put together a tasting where he was trying to get a wine from every decade from 1900. So this was like, wow. You know, late 90s. Couldn't quite get it. So the oldest bottle he had was a bottle of 1929 Chateau Lafite.
Yeah.
And that wine just blew my mind. From like, I was like, oh, this is a 70 plus year old wine that I'm trying right now. And the fact that it still had life and like, it was still complex. There was all this stuff going on. It's like, it just kind of like opened my eyes to wine in a way that I just looked at it as a beverage or sort of a food that, you know, that came with the meal.
Yeah.
Not as something that was also something to think about the history of the place and thinking of it as sort of a time capsule that you were then opening however many years later for capturing an entire year.
That is crazy. So, you know, that makes total sense. A wine that when it was released, it was 10 years before the Second World War and still filled with that vibrance and energy. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And what was kind of special about that wine, too, is that it was my dad's birth year wine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that was the night that at least started to push you into that direction. And what attracted you to Dana Estates? I know, you know, I want to talk, but you've worked, you know, all over. You worked in Germany and Australia. What was it about Dana?
So what really sort of drew me to Dana was, the real commitment by the Lee family to really looking to produce wines, one with longevity, but really with a long-term focus. And I think that's something that, you know, is somewhat of a cultural thing, but it's also something that you see in Europe where, you know, they've been making wine for hundreds of years. And so there's a real thought to, well, we're not going to do something that is going to be, you know, gone in 10 years. Like, our thought is, like, we want this to be around for 600 years.
Yeah.
And really with a thought to the next generation. And in terms of winemaking and grape growing, that's something that I've sort of, you know, growing up in the California wine industry was not necessarily my focus when I started. But the longer I was in the industry, the more I saw how important that long-term vision was. And I really appreciate working for a winery where that is the focus. And the thought is long-term, not short-term.
On your LinkedIn account, it says you speak German. Why is it that Germany makes all wine terms so long with 17 different consonants, like just 17 different vowels?
Because that's just sort of the way the Germans think.
It's crazy. Like, studying, just in all my studies, just when it got to Germany, I'm like, okay. You almost had to, like, relax, you know, your mouth before you started getting in on it. What are the biggest challenges? Because I want to sort of bounce all around. I also like to talk to you about UC Davis, but the Rutherford Appellation, and just you, as a lot of your wines are blended from four different vineyards. And I'd love to get into that. But what would you say is the biggest challenge making wine in Germany versus Australia? Like, what was the number one thing from each that would always be most difficult?
So I'd say in both places was the language. So my mother's from northern Germany, so from Hamburg, and so she speaks what we call Hochdeutsch, which is High German. It's like the proper German that people learn in school.
Yeah.
There's also a dialect, but I was never taught the dialect that she spoke. And I show up in the Pfalz, southern Germany, just north of Strasbourg, so north of Alsace, and they speak a dialect that is completely unintelligible to me. And I speak pretty good German. I mean, I grew up in California, so I'm not perfect, but I could not understand a single thing that anyone said for at least 2 weeks. Might as well have been in, like, you know, Japan or Russia.
Yeah.
And it took a while to really kind of, like, understand the dialect and, like, be able to talk to anybody. The guy that was running it, his dad was pretty good. You know, he'd sort of hand it off to his son, Karl Heinz. And so the family, you know, they would switch and speak High German to me, so I'd have some clue what the hell was going on. But, like, I couldn't understand anything. So that was the biggest challenge. But, you know, what was really fun was, like, we made some ice wine when I was there, and, like, going out in insulated rubber boots and trying to hike up and down a frozen hill with grapes on your back was, I'll say, that was pretty challenging.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I was going to ask, you know, did you ever have any scary, harrowing moments in the vineyards? Because for people who don't know, in Germany, it is incredibly steep. You know, it's like being in Cote Roti, you know, and sometimes even steeper. I guess that's sort of one of the answers. I mean, was there any scary moments?
Well, like, luckily the Pfalz is what we would call it's a flat region in comparison to what people think of as, like, the Mosel or the Saar. Yeah, so, I mean, but still, like, there's some decent hills there, but, you know, nothing crazy. Like, in the other regions, there's places where they spray the grapes via helicopter. You have to haul the grapes out. There's a guy with a harness on getting pulled up by the tractor by a winch.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to do any of that.
Okay. And by the way, any wine from that area, no one should complain what the cost is. Someone was on a winch getting you the grapes. What was it like harvesting the ice wine? Because, you know, it has to be a certain temperature, I believe. I don't know if by law it has to be by night, but you have to do it at a pretty cold environment.
It's probably just like commuting in Toronto on a regular winter day.
It's been the worst. 2019 has sucked here. It really has.
Yeah, I mean, it's cold. You're basically picking frozen berries off of a plant, putting it in a bucket, putting it in a backpack, hiking it up. You know, so it's usually around like 4 or 5 a.m., the coldest time during the night. But still, compared to a Toronto winter, it's probably like you guys would be out there in shorts and t-shirt.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But there's nothing worse than that when the Canadians, it's still cold and they're walking in shorts. Like, what are you doing? It's like, I'm from Canada. I'm like, I don't care where you're from. You're still being a dummy here. Put some pants on. And then I guess that's a hell of a contrast, between, working in wine in Australia in terms of temperature.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Australia was pretty darn pleasant from a temperature perspective. But again, the language was challenging. You know, people are asking you to pass the torch and I'm looking around for the burning brand. Yeah. You know, so like the whole dialect of, like, yeah, it's English, it's my native language, but like they speak it in a totally different way.
You were at, I believe, Master of Science at UC Davis?
I got a degree in enology, a master's degree in enology from Davis. So that was sort of before I got into wine. I went to school in Massachusetts and was basically like did the pre-med program, was going to go to medical school. And then sort of the last second was like, I'm not sure if that's the direction I want to go. So sort of right in the 90s during the tech boom. And so I went back and I worked for Intel for a year. And it was just a lot of sitting in a cubicle, crunching numbers, spreadsheets, presentations. And I was like, this is a little soul sucking. Like, I like being outside. I'm a very active person. I like doing all sorts of stuff outside. And it's like, this just isn't for me. And there's no science. And I really did love like the biology and the chemistry that I had studied as part of the pre-med program. So I switched, moved back to California. I was in Oregon at the time. Moved back to California and started working for a biotech pharmaceutical consulting firm. And it ended up being the same thing, reports and numbers and spreadsheets.
You're back in the cubicle.
And back in the cubicle, the numbers just related to different things. And writing reports for people that, half the time they're like, no, that might be the data, but I don't care. I'm still going to do what I'm going to do. And it was just didn't really have a purpose. And that's when I sort of decided, I'm like, I got to do something different with my life. And I'd always been interested in food. And then obviously this was sort of post that aha wine moment. And I was like, what about wine? Like, that would be interesting. There's a lot of science and stuff in that. And so I started looking around and decided that being a chef was way too hard, too much work. And, winemaking, you had to work hard once a year during harvest, but the rest of the year sounded pretty chill. And that's what sort of drove me in that direction.
You know what's funny about this? This might be the first case where your family was happy. Excuse me. Your family was happy that you chose not to go into medicine, but to go into wine. Like, was your dad like thrilled that you would choose that one over the other path?
He was pretty excited being such like a wine nut himself, but he was a doctor and that was part of the reason that I was interested going into medicine. So like, there's still a lot of things that really fascinate me and I find really, rewarding. But I sort of look at it this way. I didn't become a doctor. I just became a pharmacist.
Yeah. Oh, in wine, it's, you're right. It is biology and science and weather and it's, geology. It's 100 different things. What is it that makes UC Davis so special? Because, there's been so many great winemakers that have passed through that school. What is it about there?
What I really took away from Davis was approaching winemaking in a really analytical way, using that real scientific approach to underpin how you approach what is really a very creative, fluid process. Mm-hmm. And so just getting that really solid foundation in coming at it from a very technical, from a very science-driven perspective, I feel like gave me a really great foundation in the technical aspects of winemaking. Now, you learn all those technical aspects and there's like, your pH should be here and your acid level should be here. And then you get out into the real world and it's like, it doesn't quite apply in the same with the same precision that you learned at Davis, but it creates that foundation that then allows you to handle a lot of different situations that come up in real world, in the real world. A vintage throws at you a really cool year with, chemistry that's not what you're expecting, or a really hot year. And then what do you do to react to that?
I want to talk about your wines in a second. I've tried them before. Really excited. And again, we're at the National Club for Dinard wine tasting. It was, I think, sold out pretty quickly for an event like this, and rightfully so. Incredible wines that, though they're not inexpensive, the quality level, I think they're fair, especially when you consider just how expensive Napa Cabernet Sauvignon is. I think your prices are fair. I think people should probably grab them now. I feel in 5 to 6 years, they're going to, do that bump. On this podcast, I've railed against, and it's not just Napa Cabernet, but it's more $20 Napa Cabernet. Can you realistically make a good version for that price point that still is varietally correct where it's not sort of filled with a lot of chemicals or sugar or a lot of really industrial yeasts. And I don't even mean this as a negative against the winemakers. That land is expensive. That labor is expensive. Then to try to do that and still get a wine in that sort of 1995 psychological, you know, price point where people will buy it, I don't know how that's possible. And I'm curious. I mean, you work in Rutherford. You work making great Cabernet. Is it possible?
I'm not a finance guy, but I'm glad I'm not.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say it's a challenging thing to do, to get it to that price point where you're still making any profit at all.
Yeah.
You know, like it's because like all those factors you said, like one, the land is expensive. Like if you look at the land area of Napa Valley and the Napa Valley Appellation, it's like less than 20% the land area of Bordeaux. So there's not a lot of land.
You know what? I didn't even think about it like that. Yeah, you're right.
And so there's a lot of people that want to be in Napa. They want to have a wine brand. And so there's a certain amount of limited real estate with a lot of demand.
Yeah.
So that drives up the prices. And then once you've paid a certain amount per acre, I mean, there's acres going for $1 million an acre for plantable land, you know, with a vineyard on it. That's a lot of money for 1 acre of dirt.
Yeah.
And so when you start doing the math from there, like just your invested cost, I mean, that's for primo vineyard land, but still it's, you start doing that, you start looking at the cost of labor in California, the limited availability of the real estate, just the general cost of doing business. Napa Valley has done a huge amount to preserve the agricultural nature of the valley. But with that comes a lot of regulations to protect the environment. It is a difficult place to do business. And so there's a lot of costs layered on just on the regulatory side as well. You know, and then you want to build a winery, you want to custom crush your grapes. I think it's people that are doing it at that price point are doing a pretty amazing job to be able to bring Napa Valley Cabernet to people at that price point.
Yeah, and well, it is. And I guess my problem is that when I'll try them, they don't really taste like Napa Cab. They taste Cabernet-ish, and it's more like a red juice, and it's a little bit sweet. And I mean, I guess I don't really begrudge them, because you're going to have to cut corners and mass production, and you're going to have to do all those things if you wanted to make it 1995. It's why, you know, I tell people that are on a budget, if you want Cabernet Sauvignon from America, Livermore Valley, or go north to Washington, you know, and even, of course, even Washington's expensive. Like, you have to sort of go to other areas. Because I've yet to have one in the last decade that I'm like, this is a really well-made wine. I wouldn't even expect you to do it, because people got rent, mortgages, you know, school isn't cheap. So I don't really have a problem with it. I think it's unrealistic to do the character of a California Napa Cabernet for 1995, where there's not a lot of intervention going in.
You know, I think what you hit upon is like to be able to do that, you need to do it at scale.
Yeah.
So you get the efficiencies that like we don't have. Like, you know, we make just a few thousand cases of wine. It's not, you know, it's not possible at certain scales to be able to do that.
So let's talk about your wines. First off, just the Rutherford Appellation. On this podcast, I like going wine geeky, but I also like the biographical. I like hearing the stories of the winemakers or anyone in the biz. But just more on the geeky side, the Rutherford Appellation. What are the differences between that and some of the other appellations, you know, in the surrounding area?
So why don't I just like, I'll lay the groundwork in terms of where our vineyards are. So the winery is in Rutherford. We have about 7 acres planted around the winery.
Yeah, Helms
Vineyard. The Helms Vineyard. So H.W. Helms was a German viticulturist that originally planted the property back in the 1880s. And so the old winery was incorporated into the winery today. And so part of our, you know, tasting room and part of the new winery is incorporating those ruins. And there's a keystone in the main doorway to the winery from 1883.
Cool.
So, I mean, it's really cool to have that history incorporated into something new within Napa Valley.
Or only 36 years younger than that bottle of 29 Lafite you had.
Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy.
But, you know, when you look at it on the grand scale of wine history, it's still pretty young.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So we're on the northern edge of the Rutherford Appellation. So you know, West Zinfandel Lane is literally sort of almost on our northern property line. And that's okay. the change between Rutherford and St. Helena Appalachian. Mm-hmm. And so the soils are a little bit different than they are on the far southern side of the Appalachian, where it's a little bit more of a bale clay loam. And so what we have is a Perkins gravelly loam. So mm-hmm. a little bit more gravel. We're kind of tucked up right against the hillside. So it is technically sort of in the bench, you know, the Rutherford bench, but just a little bit different in terms of the composition of the soil and where it's located compared to some of the classic vineyard properties along the Rutherford bench. So the Inglenooks, the BVs, mm-hmm. Sort of historically.
And what about, just tell me a little bit more about the four vineyards. I think Helms, Lotus, Crystal Springs, and the Hershey Vineyard. Have I missing any?
That's it. So yeah. There's four properties. So Helms on the valley floor is about, just to sort of set the elevation of where we're talking about.
Yeah, please.
Helms is on the west side of the Napa Valley, about two-thirds of the way up. Mm-hmm. Again, tucked against the western hills. And those soils are older soils. They're like marine uplift. So basically seafloor, it's been pushed up into a mountain range and then weathered away onto through streams into creating a alluvial fan. Now we're going over to the Crystal Springs Vineyard, which is on the Mayacamas Mountains, which is the eastern mountains that border Napa Valley. And those are much younger soils. So for that entire mountain range, the bedrock is rhyolite. So it's a rhyolitic bedrock, which is sort of it's a little bit like granite in terms of that it's like a surface-cooled volcanic rock. But it's very like tufa-like. It has sort of almost a chalky texture to it. And the color changes depending on what other minerals are in it. So that's the underlying bedrock. And then how decomposed and what the mix of a little bit more clay or something is what changes between the Crystal Springs, Lotus, and Hershey. So Crystal Springs is at 900 feet.
Yep.
Lotus is at 1,200 feet.
Yep.
And Hershey is at 1,800 feet. So double the height of Crystal.
How different, before, I imagine, you know, when you blend them, how different is that? What impact does that altitude have? Same grape, different altitude. What are the characteristics?
So as you're sitting a little bit lower, Crystal Springs is a southwest-facing slope. So that's very warm. It gets a lot of sunlight. It sits sort of right at the fog line. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times it's above the fog. So first thing in the morning, it's still getting sun, even when the valley floor is socked in fog. And it's by far our warmest site. It's the earliest pick Cabernet that I've ever worked with in Napa Valley. I'm usually picking it mid-September. Mm-hmm. Moving up the hill a little bit. And so just to take a step back, because of that sunlight, the berries generally have very thick skins, generally a smaller berry, and a really sort of like big, broad, robust tannin structure to the wine.
Yeah.
So that's what that particular site gives.
Yep.
Moving up the hill to Lotus, you get the same tannin structure, but because the vineyard sits from that southwest all the way rolling around over a little knoll to almost a north-facing slope, you get a little bit more complexity across the vineyard block, and the rock is much closer to the surface. So literally, you walk through the vineyard, there's big chunks of rock just strewn everywhere, and that particular vineyard is 100% hand-farmed because the slopes are so steep that we can't really run tractors safely. So everything is done in that vineyard by hand, which makes it kind of a unique place. And the wines there, they also have that robustness, but because of that kind of change in the aspect, as well as the bedrock being closer to the surface, the vines really struggle a lot more. And so you get a little bit more polish to the tannins and a little bit more of a flow to the wines and a precision, where Crystal is a little bit more... If I was going to describe it, it's kind of the difference between American muscle car and like, you know, Italian stitched sports car.
Yeah. Cool. No, I think people are always interested in that. I mean, part of this podcast is to get people to learn and just what altitude does and just how it just, it's crazy how you can't be, geographically, you're not that far apart, yet the grapes stylistically are. And I think that's one thing that people always get into.
Yeah, and those two vineyards are, you know, probably less than half a mile apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, really producing different wines. And then bumping up to Hershey at 1,800 feet,
yep,
you're definitely above the fog line, but the days are much cooler, even if the nights are warmer, because you don't get the fog influence. So a little bit warmer at night, but overall just cooler. And so you retain a lot more acidity in the wines. But also you get with a Cabernet Sauvignon, what I call sort of the secondary and tertiary flavors of Cabernet. So you're getting a little bit more earthiness. You're getting a savory character to the wines instead of, you know, they still have a really beautiful fruit to them, but that's layered in with these other things that you don't get as much of at those, in those warmer locations.
Let's talk a little bit about winemaking. You guys, dry farming. I was wondering if you could explain what that is and what the benefits. And now I'm doing a bad job because I'm asking too many questions in one question. Was that all influenced by your time in Australia? Because I know in Australia, dry farming is very prominent.
Well, in Australia, it's because they have no water.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no choice.
Yeah.
In a lot of places.
Yeah, you're forced into it. So, yeah. Well, we're dry farmers here. Well, no, everyone is.
Yeah. So in California, the rules are a little bit different. So a lot of places in Europe, it's against the law to irrigate. And then there's places like Australia where they just can't because they don't have, you know, they don't have water. In California, you know, especially in Napa Valley, we're kind of blessed. We're not really impacted by, you know, snowfall the way that a lot of the state is in terms of our water. It's all coming from groundwater that's being deposited by rain during the year. So we have a decent supply of water on all of our properties. But the reason for dry farming is really to try to force the vines to dig deeper, to basically pull the water from lower areas of the soil structure, and also so that they struggle a little bit more. That's not to say that we're dry farming everything, but the goal is to try to get to a place where we're doing minimal irrigation,
yeah,
and hopefully one day dry farming, because you can't, you know, you can't just cut them off.
Yeah.
Like 1 year you're irrigating them and the next year you're not.
It's like trying to quit smoking. You're not going to just stop. You're going to wean off slowly. You're going to go back a little bit, but it's about a long process.
And what, you know, in my mind, from a winemaking perspective, what it's really about is trying to find that balance where you're providing stress at the right times of year so that the wines that you're producing have that interest and complexity and depth to them. In a way, if you're just applying water every week, the way you would for your like tomatoes in your vegetable garden.
Yeah.
That they won't. And, you know, to be honest, your tomatoes in your vegetable garden, if you eke the water back, you're going to have a richer, more flavorful tomato, which I'm sure if you go to a farmer's market, that's being grown very different than the mass market tomato that you buy in the grocery store, and they taste different. It's the same thing with grapes.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. I never thought of it. I like that. How important is fresh and acidity? Because I think the one criticism, you know, certainly more in the 90s, was the big, more overly extracted Cabernet, where the idea was just power, big. You know, there's certainly more of a shift of it. I think there's probably a growing more taste for that sort of wine. How important is it? And also, how difficult is it to sort of straddle that line? Because, you know, Cabernet, it's a big grape about straddling that line between having that power. You still want power and structure, but bringing in the freshness and acidity.
I think that's like in the wine industry, you see trends where people are swinging, swinging back.
It goes all over the place.
And so I think we're swinging towards that fresher style. And like, you know, like in everything, there's people that kind of go overboard a little bit too far in one direction.
Yeah.
But I think what it's doing is it's showing that, you know, having a little bit more brightness and energy in the wines makes them better wines overall. And there was this, like you said, you know, in the 90s, I think we went too far the other way. There was too much power. There's too much richness. And at a certain point, you're like, this is amazing for one glass. But then after that, you're like, I'm not going to finish the bottle. Like,
yeah.
Where's my friends?
Yeah.
Versus, you know, like, you know, in my mind, what I see as a great wine is a bottle that I open and I want to share, but I could drink the whole bottle.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow, that is so good. It has, there's so many things going on. It's constantly changing in the glass. And as I go through the bottle that like, you know, maybe it's not the most responsible thing to do, but I could definitely drink that whole bottle of wine because it's just hitting on so many points.
And as long as you're not driving and you got water and food, you know, and you got many hours, you know.
But I think that's where people are sort of moving back towards in Napa Valley. And it's a warm Appalachian. So, you know, you know, you just have to understand too that like you need to, part of a wine really representing a place is understanding what that place is and not trying to force your wines into being like a wine from a different place in the world.
Yeah.
And so an understanding that Napa Valley is a place that has certain climactic challenges, but also is blessed with a lot of amazing things in terms of where it sits. And the fact that we have, you know, to be honest, pretty fabulous weather that makes it relatively easy to grow grapes. And our challenge is heat, you know, and you go to Burgundy and it's hail and rain. You know, they people are dealing with different challenges depending on where they're growing grapes. Or you go to Mendoza and it's hail, you know, or birds. So, you know, everyone's got their own challenge, and how you react to that is really what makes the place, how you tweak the vintage. But there's an imprint of the weather and the land that you shouldn't try to basically make out of the wine.
Yeah, and it's funny, you talk about trends, and it's so true. And then everything's going to become, you know, oh, we're all biodynamic and we're unfiltered and we just got this funky wine, and, you know, sometimes they go too far. And what I wouldn't want for California, I like freshness, I like acid. I wouldn't want them to swing too much. Like, okay, we're going to be just like France. You sort of hinted at it. I want California wine to taste like California wine. I don't want them to try to overcompensate because they want to make, you know, Cabernet that tastes like Beaujolais. That would be swinging. As much as we don't like the over-extracted, I would hate the other end of that pendulum as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you said you're happy to get a little bit geeky in this podcast, but, like, you know, there's sort of two different types of ripeness for wine grapes. You have what I call technical maturity and then phenological maturity.
Yep.
And so technical maturity is your sugar level, your acid, so your pH and your TA, or total acidity in the wine. And then you have your phenological maturity, which is looking at the grape, you're tasting it. Are the tannins ripe? Are they sweet tannins, or are they green tannins, or are they hard tannins? Are the seeds or the pips ripe? Are they nice and brown and nutty and crunchy and something you could eat? Or are they still have a green stripe in them? Or are they bright green and, like, you know, they're so astringent that you feel like you just put a tea bag in your mouth? Like, where is the grape on that spectrum? And then what are the flavors like? Are you at red fruit? Are you before that? Are you more to, like, a cucumber, you know, herbalness? Are the skins tasting green and bell peppery? That's not ripe.
Yeah.
And if that's when you hit 23 bricks because you want to make a 13.5 alcohol California wine, like, you're going to have a green, hard wine that's really not that pleasant. So one of the challenges is, how do you grow grapes in a warm climate to try to push your technical maturity farther down the road? Because in California, the challenge is we hit the sugar ripeness earlier than we hit the phenological or flavor ripeness.
Right. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So how do we try to get those two to overlap? And then, you know, then it becomes a choice of style. Do you want a richer, more extracted, softer, riper wine? Or do you want something that's going to be a little bit fresher and more acidity? And I think, to what we were talking about earlier, the trend is to try to pick in that phenological ripeness window a little bit on the more red fruit side. And you're seeing more people picking on that side. And you're seeing, you know, more consumers being interested in drinking wines. For Donna Estates, you know, Mr. Lee really loves older wines. And so the goal is to make wines that are going to be ageable for 20 and 30 and 40 years.
Yeah.
And so that balance of acidity and tannins is really critical to creating a wine that's going to still be fresh and have life, like that 1929 I had. I mean, that's part of the reason it was still alive, is because it had tannin and acidity. And so, you know, it's that triangle between acidity, tannin, and alcohol that is really finding that balance to have a wine that's going to be enjoyable to drink, but that will also age for decades. I mean, in California, I think it's a fine line to walk.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Tell me about your wines. Tell me about Donna Estate. How would you describe, like, the wines we're having tonight? How would you describe them?
So I'll start with the single vineyard wines, just to give a sense of what the different places are, and then jump onto the, you know, we make a couple of blended Cabernets as well.
Yeah.
They're different blends from the different vineyards. So starting down in the valley floor at Helms, so I think of Helms as sort of the most elegant of the wines that we're making. So sort of has the creamiest palate to it, really beautiful aromatics that really jump out of the glass with blackberries and violets, little, you know, almost like a cassis kind of character there. Mm-hmm. And on the palate, creamy, a lot softer, a little bit lighter and livelier, but really keeps that Rutherford character with, you know, what people call the Rutherford dust, which I would describe as it's a textural thing, but also a little bit of a, it's like having cocoa powder, that very fine, yep, powdery, dusty sensation on towards the finish of the wine, with a little bit of a chocolatey feel to it, or flavor to it. Stepping up to the next vineyard, Lotus, in terms of height. Lotus is really, it's very muscular and intense, got a lot of dark fruit, but a really, the tannin structure of Lotus is really kind of what makes, is the signature of the site. But with this really beautiful precision, the way that it flows across the palate is really great. And then moving up to the Hershey Vineyard, Hershey again being the coolest and highest site, Hershey really sits with this combination of red fruit and black fruit. So, you know, sitting in there with, like, you know, plums as well as sort of your darker blackberry, like blackberry compote kind of flavors,
yeah,
but with a real minerality. And so the tannin structure there, where Lotus is very broad across your mouth, Hershey really is kind of a, what I call a linear tannin. It sits right in the center of your palate.
Much more angular.
That sort of fine and precise feel with a real minerality. So you can describe this 100 ways, but, like, I think of it as, like, you know, wet rocks, you know, or I think it, I have this association with, because I grew up in California, with the Sierra Mountains, which are granite. And, like, it, to me, it has almost this flavor of rain on warm granite in the summer. And so that, that character is, you know, whether we also have some Sauvignon Blanc that we grow at Hershey as well, but both of those wines have that on the finish, and it's part of sort of the DNA of the site. But then also Hershey being cooler, it has some of those secondary flavors, a little bit more of a savory character, a little bit of earthiness in there as well.
And the blends, I think people always want to know, because yours, Cabernet, Malbec, Merlot, and Petit Verdot. What do each one of them bring? Because I know some of the blends, it's been like 89% Cab, 5% Malbec, 3% Merlot, and 3% Petit Verdot. If, you know, in a sentence or two, what do each one of them bring to the blend?
So what I would say is the base being, so there's two different blended Cabernets. So there's Vaso, which is sort of based at Hershey, and then there's Onda, which its real backbone is Crystal Springs. Mm-hmm. So starting with Vaso, which is the one that has really a lot of the other blenders in it, with its basis at Hershey, the Merlot really to me brings like a bright red fruit character, along with kind of a black tea note. Mm-hmm. The Petit Verdot is a blue fruit. So, you know, blueberries or something along those lines, but really an upfront tannin that is really very different than Cabernets. I think of it as more vertical than horizontal. That's kind of a weird, hard to,
no, you know, but it's true. I once, someone described to me the difference between Chasson, Montrachet, and Poulinet. And they said Poulinet, and they just pointed. And Chasson, they more did like a sweeping gesture. Yeah. And when I tried both of them, it made sense. I know how that might seem weird, and I hope this doesn't seem like that's being pretentious, but in my brain, something went, oh yeah, that works for me.
Yeah, and I think there's something about just sort of describing wine that's like there's so many different ways to describe it.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know I sometimes have a bad habit of doing this, is like you can be overly technical and precise about, okay, well, this is the language I use when I'm talking to other people that make wine. And, you know, once you taste with someone enough, you're speaking the same language, but then to speak to a broader audience that's never tasted wine with you before, it's difficult because you're not necessarily on the same page as having tasted 100 wines together and, yeah, knowing, you know, when I say earthy, you think dirty socks,
yeah,
or whatever it is. Like, you know, my blackberry may be your raspberry.
Yep.
And so, you know, when you taste with someone enough, you know, they say raspberry, I taste blackberry. Okay, I know what they're saying.
Yeah.
But if you've never talked to someone about wine before, then you're not necessarily speaking the same language.
Do you have problems at dinner parties? How are you, like, dinner parties? Or you go to someone's place for dinner or Christmas or a birthday? Do people get intimidated? Do you sometimes find yourself getting into the technical talk? Like, oh, wait a minute. Wait, no. I gotta change my adjectives and verbs.
Usually I just get embarrassed because I start slurping air through my wine.
Yeah.
Because I'm like being kind of like, again, getting overly technical in my own head and I can't help it. And people are like me like, what the hell's wrong with that guy? Like, yeah. Why is he slurping?
Yeah. Do you have like friends?
So rude.
Do you have friends or a partner that's like, hey, Chris, stop that right now.
My wife laughs at me when I swirl my water glass.
Oh.
Because it's like a nervous tick. If there's a glass on the table and you swirl it.
All right, then let me ask you this. Have you ever smelt the water and forgot for a second? Have you ever, you're swirling the water and you're going for a smell and you're like, oh, what am I doing? It's water. Because I got caught doing that years ago and my friends will not let, they won't let me live that down.
Well, you had to see what the chlorine level in the water was or if they'd filtered it.
Exactly. I wish I was smart enough to give that answer at that moment. Before I let you go, I was doing a little just the research when you were working, I think it was Hewitt, your 2010 cab, got number 4 on the Wine Spectator list for 2014. What did that do to your life? Did it have any sort of impact? Comedians would talk about when they would go on Johnny Carson. Once you've gone on Carson once, then, everything changed and you'd be booked for more gigs. Did it have any change in your life?
I mean, besides the fact that was the 2010 was the year that we had our kids, and that was a life-changing experience.
Yeah. I won't ask you which was more important. Yeah, we'll go with your children.
I think the benign neglect that the wine received from me focusing on my children probably did wonders for my winemaking. Stop focusing so much on it. Yeah. It was a
non-interventionist year for you.
Yeah, it was a great honor to be able to have a wine that I made, selected for their number 4 wine of the year.
Yeah.
I think, from a winemaking perspective, one of the coolest things was just being able to go and talk to that many people about the wine and present the wine to the wine experience in New York.
Yeah.
It's like, it's pretty cool to have 1,000 people like listening to you for 5 minutes talking about your wine. And sort of made me think about, I'd say one of the big things it did was it made me think about wine and winemaking and how many people you're really touching in terms of that are really having a great experience by drinking a wine, whether it's yours or somebody else's.
Yeah.
Having that many people in the room just like at rapt attention because they're truly excited about what you have created, it sort of changed the way that I looked at it. Looked at wine. I'd always sort of looked at it in that this is trying, I sort of viewed it as creating something that was something that I could put on the table and be proud of having made it and people could take it or leave it. But I never really thought about it on that scale.
Right.
That it really was touching that many people and that many people might be opening this bottle at a dinner party or taking it to a friend's house or at the birth of a child or a wedding. And
you felt more responsibility.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was interesting. It really changed my view of like, oh yeah, like this is something that really is becoming part of a lot of people's lives. And so like, don't screw it up.
Yeah, that responsibility. It's like I do radio for my normal job. I'm a sportscaster, and people every now and then. It doesn't happen a lot. I mean, there's a lot bigger celebrities than me. I'm like a near Z level. But every now and then, when someone's like, oh yeah, I caught what you said, I'm like, wait, you were listening? I just assumed the guy behind the glass, my producer, is the only one listening. I sometimes forget that maybe other people are listening as well. And it does sort of change the perspective. These are beautiful wines. They're a great expression of just what Napa Cabernet is supposed to be. They're not cheap, and neither are a lot of wines from that area when they're that well made. And, the dry farming, the low yields, that some of it hand-picked, your wines are in wonderful sites. If you could explain to someone, hey, I'm not asking you to buy 4 cases and drink this on Wednesday, but, why do you think someone should pick a couple bottles of these up, throw them away, and open them on Christmas? What would be your sales pitch? I know it's sort of an awkward question.
Well, I think one of the things that the winery has been focused on from the beginning is really trying to create wines that capture a sense of place. Mm-hmm. And everything we're doing in the vineyards and the winery is geared towards really expressing you know, Rutherford, you know, our Lotus Vineyard, or up on Howe Mountain, our Hershey Vineyard, for every single vintage. And the care and attention and detail that we provide to every single vine, like, you know, we're farming organically, but we're not farming organically because we can put organic on the label, is because we feel that's the right thing to do to produce a wine that is going to have more clarity to it, more precision to the flavors. You know, why are we harvesting everything by hand into 30-pound picking lugs? Well, because we feel like that has a real impact on the way that the wine tastes when it's in the bottle, when someone opens it. All those little details all the way through the process, you know, it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of focus by a whole team of people.
There's a lot of hands that are going on that way.
Yeah,
that
wine. It's not just myself. It's myself and all the people in the vineyard that are doing all the hard work to make sure that we're out there at exactly the right time doing, you know, pulling a leaf off here, snipping part of a cluster off there, making sure that, you know, this vine gets water and that vine doesn't. And that, you know, when I call a pick and I say pick, you know, these vines and not those vines, that happens the way that it needs to happen. There's a lot of detail that goes into making a very small amount of wine.
Yeah.
And really the goal behind all this detail and all this hard work is really trying to capture to the best of our ability, what is it about this place and how do we get that into the bottle?
Hyper-specific means it's costly, but it also means you're getting the best quality. And I thought you put it best there, just the sense of what that year and what that place is. Chris Cooney, thank you so much for doing the podcast. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to trying a bunch of the wines tonight here at the National Club. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can always find this on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever good podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.